Vanishing Acts, Disc 8.
Inker, the resident tattoo artist, melts down chess pieces for the monochrome green pigment he uses in his craft. His client already has sleeves, a run of tattoos covering his arms from wrist to shoulder. It says White Pride down each of his triceps, and on his back is a Celtic knot. You can tell a lot about inmates by reading their skin. The swastikas and the twin lightning bolts tell you their racial affiliation. The spider webs and Constantine wire tell you they've been in prison. The clock faces have hands placed to show you how many years they did time. I wonder where Inker plans on putting this new one. He will scrape the skin with a sharpened shank and rub the ink into it to scar. He'll do it all in record time, between the detention officers' walkthroughs, meant to keep things like this from going on. Behind the cover of a card game, Inker bends down over the bared left shoulder blade of his customer and begins to dig. Blood welling up in the shape of a heart. 5-0, one of the card players says. A warning that an officer's coming. Inker slips his shank under his stripes, hides the tiny packet of ink in the ham of his hand. But the guard that passes by doesn't even glance at Inker. He moves to the upper level, down the block of cells. I rise, running after him. By the time I reach my cell, the detention officer has balled the bedding into a heap and tossed the mattresses off the bunks. He overturns my little cache of soap, toothbrush, postcards, pencils. Then he reaches under the bunk for Concise's cardboard box. Concise isn't here. He's left the pod to attend church services. It is not that he's particularly religious, but going to church allows him the freedom to sell his bootleg alcohol to inmates he would not otherwise see. Of course, after having the cell tossed, he won't have any merchandise, and once he is moved to close custody, he won't have the means to make it at all anymore. The detention officer opens up a tube of toothpaste, puts a taste on his finger, and lifts to his tongue. Then he reaches for the shampoo bottle full of hooch and unscrews the cap. "It's mine," I blurt out. I would like to tell you that I'm being selfless when I say this, but it would be another lie. What I'm thinking is that Concise and I have a fragile trust. To start from scratch with a new roommate could be a disaster. What I'm thinking is that I have little to lose, and Concise has everything. What I'm thinking is that there might be a karmic balance to the acts one undertakes in life, that maybe keeping one person's existence as is can erase the time you changed someone else's. Being in disciplinary segregation is like being a ghost, something at which I've actually had a fair amount of practice. The officers get right into your face, yet don't seem to really see you. For 1 hour each day, you are allowed into the day room by yourself, to shower and to haunt a greater space. You go for hours without using your voice. You live in the past, because the present stretches out so far, it hurts to glimpse it. Since there are an odd number of prisoners in the pod, I am in a cell by myself. At first, I consider this a blessing. Then I begin to have my doubts. There is no one to talk to. to have to step around. Anything to break up my routine becomes a gift. So when I am told that my attorney has arrived for a visit, there's nothing I'd like more than to be taken down to the visiting room, if only for a diversion. But there is also nothing I'd like less. I know why you asked Eric to be my lawyer. But at the time, you didn't know the whole story. And neither did Eric. It is clear, from our last meeting, that Eric can't easily separate my story from his own. Would he have agreed to represent me if he'd known that he'd have to walk through the memories of his drinking all over again? Please tell my attorney, I say, that I'd rather not. A half hour later, the inmates begin to stir. A few of them start hollering. Others begin to pace like hamsters in a cage. I look back over my shoulder to see what's causing the stir and find Sergeant Doucette leading Eric toward my cell. I turn my back. I don't want to speak to him. He doesn't want to speak to you, she tells Eric. Eric inhales sharply. Well, that's fine by me. Because God knows I don't feel like hearing what the hell landed you in lockdown. At that moment, I remember when I first realized that Eric was going to be the one to take care of you after I let go. You were 14 and had just had 4 teeth pulled by the dentist. Your whole face was numb with Novocaine. Eric came to our house after school to visit. And I let him take you the chocolate milkshake you'd asked for. When the liquid dribbled down your chin, Eric wiped it with a napkin. Before he let go, though, he let his fingertips caress the side of your face as if he was finding his way across a relief map. He did this even though, or maybe because, the dentist's shot kept you from feeling it. Let him in, I tell the officer. He is uncomfortable, holding on to the bars like a swimmer afraid to leave the side of the pool. What are you doing in here? He asks. Self-preservation. I'm just trying to save you, too. Are you sure about that? I say. He looks away. This case isn't about me. When he asks me to start over, I have to think twice. It would be so easy to say no, to receive a court-appointed attorney and be convicted. I've given up my life before. I could do it again. But there is another part of me that needs to see Eric succeed. He's my granddaughter's father. And you love him. I can still remember you sobbing against my shoulder after you drove him to rehab. If Eric loses this legal battle, will he start drinking and make you cry again? If he wins, will it make me believe what I couldn't when I looked into Elise's face, that someone who is given a second chance might actually make something worthwhile of it? I rub my palms on the knees of my pants. I don't know what you want to hear and what you don't. Eric takes a deep breath. Tell me how you met Elise. I close my eyes, and I am a too serious, overachieving grad student again. All my life I've gotten good grades. All my life I've done what my parents have asked. Until now. It is their great shame that instead of becoming a doctor, I have chosen pharmacology. Never mind the fact that I cannot stand the sight of blood. I stand on the side of the road, kicking at the tires of my car as steam rolls out from the seam of the hood and spills onto the ground. I'm going to miss my final in pharmacokinetics because of this. 6 miles later, dusty and sweaty, after figuring every sorry permutation of my ruined grad school grade point average and tanked career, I approach a mirage. It is a roadside bar. 20 monstrous Harleys are parked in front of it. I walk inside in time to hear the screaming. 2 burly men have a stunning, black-haired girl pinned up against the wall. A 3rd holds a fan of darts in his hand. The girl closes her eyes and yells as the 1st dart goes whizzing toward her shoulder. A 2nd dart strikes inches from her ear. The biker has just lifted his hand to throw the 3rd dart when I launch myself at him. I have about as much effect as a mosquito. He bats me away and sends the 3rd dart spinning to land between her knees, nailing her skirt to the wall. The girl opens her eyes, grins, and glances down between her legs. No wonder you can't get a date, T-Bone, if that's the closest you can get. The other bikers all start laughing, and one of them extricates the girl from the darts. She walks toward me and holds out her hand to help me to my feet. I'm sorry. I thought they were hurting you, I say. Them? She glances over her shoulder at the bikers who have gone back to their arm wrestling and their drinks. They're pussycats. Come on, then. Heroes drink on the house. She ducks beneath the counter and pulls the tap, filling up a long glass of beer for me. I realize that she is the bartender. She asks me what I'm doing here, and I tell her about my car. I say that I'm missing my final. Ever wonder why it's called that? She says. It's not like everything stops when you're done with it. I don't tell Eric how I found myself watching a shaft of sunlight play Elise's skin like the bow of a violin. How she could talk to one biker about basketball stats and make change for another and smile for me at the same time. I don't tell him how she made fun of me for nursing my beer and then shared it with me. I don't tell him how she locked up early. How I drew the patterns of molecules for her on cocktail napkins. Then between the stars. And finally on the flat of her bare back. I don't tell Eric that until I met Elise, I had never stayed awake till dawn just to watch the sky burn a hole through the night. That I took my 1st go-kart ride on a track beside her. I don't tell him that she led me through graveyards to lay down flowers for people she had never known. I don't tell him how she would decorate the inside of my car with flower petals for me to find when I came out of class. That she would call me up to ask me what color I would be, if I were a color, because she was so completely purple and she wanted to know if we'd match. That she was like no one I'd ever met. That when I moved inside the kaleidoscope heart of her, I saw how dreary my life had been. I don't tell Eric this because it's all I have left of that girl. What happened? He asks. She drove me home from the bar, I say simply. A month later, I found out she was pregnant. She'd used words like should and too soon and career and abortion. I had looked right at her and asked her if she wanted to get married instead. What made you get divorced? There are a whole string of things, if I want to be honest about it. And yes, there was a trigger. But I should have known that someone who was such a child herself would not feel comfortable taking care of one. I should have been more supportive after our son was stillborn, instead of clutching Beth like a shield to ward off the grief. But most of all, I should have admitted to myself far earlier that the things I loved about Elise, the impulsiveness and the craziness and the spur-of-the-moment outlook, were not really part of her personality, but a product of the alcohol. That when she didn't drink, she was so insecure that nothing I said or did was enough to convince her that I loved her. Eric nods. He has been there himself. On both ends of the equation. You cannot depend on an alcoholic. So you learn to live for the moments when they are present. You tell yourself you'll leave. But then they do something wonderful that reels you back. Host a picnic on the living room floor in January. Find the face of Jesus in a pancake. Celebrate the cat's birthday by inviting all the other neighborhood cats for tuna. You use all the good times to paint over the bad and pretend you can no longer see the grain of the wood that she's made of. You watch her wade through sobriety and secretly wish she would drink, because that is when she turns into the person you love. And then you cannot figure out who you hate more. Yourself for thinking this, or her for reading your mind. Eric stares at me, putting together everything I've said so far. You loved her. You still love her. I never stopped, I admit. Then you didn't take Delia because you hated Elise? Eric says slowly. No, I sigh. I took Dee so that she wouldn't. Broadway gangsters, West Side City Crips, Dupa Villa, Wedgwood Chicanos, 40-ounce posse, Wetback Power 2nd Avenue, East Side Fuenicara, Hispanics Causing Panic, Hoover 59, Brown Pride, Vista King Trojans, Grape Street 103, Dope Man Association, Sex Jerks, Rollin' 60s, Mini Park, Park South, Pico Nuevo, Dogtown, Golden Gate, Mountaintop Criminal, Chocolate City, Clavelito Park, Insane Born Gangster, Vista Bloods, Casa Trece. There are 300 street gangs in the Phoenix area. These are just a few represented at Madison Street Jail. Crips dominate the Phoenix area. Bloods rule Tucson. Crips wear blue and call Bloods slobs as a sign of disrespect. They don't write the letters CK in succession, because that stands for Crip Killer, and will spell a word black, B-L-A-C-C, or slick, S-L-I-C-C, instead. A Blood wears red and calls Crips crabs. He will cross out all C's in his writing to show disrespect. Members of two different Crip gangs who meet on the street will try to kill each other. In prison, they join in solidarity against the Bloods. There was only one way to get a Crip and a Blood to stop fighting. Put them in front of an Aryan Brotherhood member, and they will suddenly be on the same side. Long before I get out of Disc Seg, there are rumors about Styx returning to the maximum security pod and talking of retribution. About Blue Lock, who has become my staunch supporter. Watching me take the blame for something one of the blacks did has, apparently, set me squarely in their esteem. When I move back down to maximum security, Concise is lying on his bunk reading.
"Was crackalackin'," he says. A homeboy greeting that could mean anything. He doesn't really speak until the detention officer leaves. "They treat you all right up on three?" I start to make up my bed with sheets and a blanket. Yeah, I got the cell with the jacuzzi and the wine cellar. "Damn, they always give that one to the white boys," he jokes. "Andrew," he says, the first time he has ever used my name. "What you did..." I fold up my towel. It was nothing. He stands up, reaches out slowly, and clasps my hand. "You took the fall for me. That was something." Embarrassed, I break away. "Well, it's over and done with." "No, it ain't," Concise says. "Styx is gonna beat a lesson into you in the rec yard. He been planning it for days now." I try not to let on how much this terrifies me. If Styx nearly beat me to death as an afterthought on the first night I was in jail, what might he do with preparation? "Can I ask you something?" Concise says. "Why'd you do it?" "Because looking out for yourself sometimes isn't about you at all. Because contrary to what inmates seem to think, situations are never black or white." But I just shake my head, unsure of how to put this into words. Concise leans down and pulls out a box beneath the lower bunk. It is filled with an arsenal of makeshift weapons. "Yeah," he says.
"I hear you."
The morning of the fight, Concise shaves my head. All the inmates involved do, because it makes it harder for the DOs to sort out the participants afterward. The disposable razor leaves patches of hair, so I look like I've been attacked by a cat. I glance at Concise's smooth, dark skin.
"Well," I say, "I'm going out on a limb here, but I think the guards might be able to tell me apart from the rest of the Crips."
There will be 30 men in the rec yard at once. 10 Mexicans, 9 blacks, and 10 whites, and me. For the past week, a steady stream of smuggling has enabled Concise to build up a weapon supply. We have stayed up late to fashion them. Clubs, rolled out of National Geographic's and secured with the tape the kitchen uses to mark a special dietary meal. Saps, a sock filled with 2 bars of soap or, in one case, a padlock nipped from an ankle chain, which can be swung at an enemy. We have broken out the single-edge razor blades we are given every morning, reset them in the pliant plastic of a melted toothbrush. We have fashioned shanks from the stainless steel frames around the mirrors in our cell, from pieces of chain link fence, from the metal stays and knee braces, even from a toilet bowl brush. All filed to a deadly point along the cement floor at night. The handles are wrapped with strips ripped from bedsheets and towels, tied tight with the white cotton string from laundry bundles. You can grip the weapon more firmly, and you are less likely to be cut as your hand slips up the blade. My own weapon has been specially made by Concise. Having pulled the metal tip off a number 2 pencil, he's inserted a sharpened staple to the eraser end and placed a fan of cigarette batting in the other side. The dart, jammed into the hollow tube of a Bic pen, can be blown into the eye of an enemy at close range. It's amazing to me, as we line up for rec, that the DOs do not realize what is going on. Everyone has a weapon packed somewhere under their stripes. Once we get to the yard, we congregate in larger groups than normal. No one wants to be separated from his allies.
No one touches the basketball.
Stay cool, Concise whispers to me. My heart is as thick as a sponge, and sweat breaks out behind my ears, in the cool crevice where my hair once was. I do not see it coming. The sap that sings like a hummingbird and whacks me on my left temple. As I fall, I am vaguely aware of the rush of bodies that push past me, the overgrown jungle of their feet. The officer's voice is high as a child's. Multiple inmates involved in a fight on the rec yard. Backup needed immediately. The window of the multi-purpose room, which overlooks the rec yard, is suddenly full of faces pressed to the glass. Guards stream through the adjacent door, trying to pull apart the blacks and browns and whites whose limbs are knotted together. Violence up close has a smell, like coppered blood and charcoal burning. I inch backward, shaking fiercely. An opening in the wall of flesh spits a body into the space beside me. Styx lifts his face and his eyes light up. The strangest details register. The locker room smell of the pavement underneath me. The cut on Styx's shoulder that is shaped like Florida. The way he has lost one shoe. My legs tremble as I back away from him. My hand curls around the blow dart. When he smiles at me, his teeth are covered in blood. "Nigger lover," he says, and he holds up a zip gun in his left hand. I know what it is, because Concise had wanted to make one, but couldn't get a bullet smuggled in time. You grind off the top and bottom of an asthma inhaler, and then tear the thin metal open. Flatten it, roll it around a pencil to make a tube that fits a .22 caliber shell like a sheath. Wrap it in cloth, and enclose it in one hand. In your other, hold the firing pin. Anything that can hit the rim of the bullet's casing when you smack one hand against the other. It is deadly accurate at a 5-foot range. I watch Styx take a bent piece of metal, a handcuff key, I realize, and position it in his right hand. He spreads his fists apart. In slow motion, I lift the tube of the big pen and seal my mouth over one end. The blow dart flies at Styx, the staple embedding deep in his right eye. He rolls away, screaming, and with trembling hands I stuff the big pen tube down a drainage gate. The DOs begin to loose pepper spray that blinds me. When I hear something skitter by my ear, I try to look at it, but my eyes are the raw red of grief. I learn it by feel, the cool metal point of a miniature missile. Without hesitation, I grab the bullet Styx has dropped.
"Easy now," a voice says behind me.
A detention officer helps me to my feet.
"I saw you feel the first blow. You all right?"
Somewhere between the moment I entered this rec yard and the moment I will leave it, I have turned myself into a person I vaguely recognize. Somebody desperate. Somebody capable of acts I never imagined until driven to commit them. Somebody I was 28 years ago. Another life in the day of a man. I nod at the officer and bring my hand to my mouth, pretending to wipe off saliva. Then, untucking the bullet from the pouch of my cheek, I swallow.
Part 5. The following quote is from The Fire of Driftwood by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The leaves of memory seem to make a mournful rustling in the dark. Delia. Ruth Ann tells Sophie that when she was a child, Hopi girls would wear their hair in whorls, intricately twisted buns above each ear. She parts Sophie's hair, ropes each side, and coils it tight. "There," she announces. "You look just like a Kuan Yauma." "What's that?" Sophie asks. "A butterfly showing beautiful wings." She wraps a shawl over Sophie's shoulders and winds two ace bandages up her legs, makeshift moccasins. "Excellent," she says. "You're ready." Today she is taking us to the Heard Museum in Phoenix, where a festival is taking place. She has packed the car full of old board games and broken watches, pens that need refills, vases with chips and cracks. "If you have nothing to do," she told us, "I could use some staff." An hour later, Sophie and I stand in the grassy bowl outside the museum, surrounded by a collection of Ruth Ann's junk, while she wanders through the crowd in her Barbie trench coat, flashing potential customers. People sit in folding chairs and on blankets, drinking bottled water and eating fry bread that costs $4. At the bottom of the outdoor pavilion is a circle where a small canopy shades a phalanx of men bent over an enormous drum. Their voices vine together and climb into the sky. Many of the onlookers are white, but more are Native American. They wear everything from traditional costumes to jeans and American flag t-shirts. Some of the men wear their hair in braids and ponytails, and everyone seems to be smiling. Several other girls have hair wound to the sides, like Sophie. Suddenly, a dancer steps into the center of the circle. "Ladies and gentlemen," the MC announces, "let's welcome Derek Deer from Sipaulovi in Hopi Land." The boy cannot be more than 16. When he walks, the bells on his costume jingle. He has a rainbow of fringe across his shoulder blades and down his arms, and he has tied a leather band around his forehead with a matching rainbow disc in the center. He wears biking shorts under his loincloth. The boy sets 5 hoops on the ground, each about 2 feet wide. As the drummers start throbbing out their song, he begins to move. He taps forward twice with his right foot, then his left, and in the instant it takes to blink, he kicks up the first hoop and holds it in his hand. He does the same with the other 5 hoops and then begins to make them extensions of his body. He steps through 2 and lines the remaining 3 up in a vertical line, then snaps the top ones open and shut in a massive jaw. Still moving his feet, he dances out of the hoops and fans all 5 across the breadth of his shoulders to turn himself into an eagle. He morphs from a rodeo horse to a serpent to a butterfly. Then he twists the hoops together, an atlas building his burden, and spins this 3-dimensional sphere out into the center of the performance ring. As the drummers cry, he dances a final circle and falls down to 1 knee. It is like nothing I have ever seen. "Ruth Ann," I say as she steps up beside me, clapping. "That was amazing.
Let's go see him."
She pecks her way between the people on the grass until we are standing behind the drummer's pavilion. The boy is sweating profusely and eating a power bar. Up close, I can see that the rainbow colors of his costume are hand-sewn ribbons. Ruth Ann boldly picks at the boy's sleeve.
"Look at these, 1 thread away from falling off," she tisks. "Your mother ought to learn how to sew."
The boy looks up over his shoulder and grins.
My aunt could probably fix them, he says, but she's too busy being a businesswoman to pay attention to the likes of me. He enfolds Ruth Ann in an embrace. Or maybe you brought your needle and thread.
I wonder why she hasn't mentioned that the dancer is her nephew. Ruth Ann holds him at arm's length.
You are turning into your father's double, she pronounces, and this makes a smile split the boy's face. Derek, this is Sophie and Delia. Ikwatsi.
I shake his hand. You were awfully good. Sophie bends down toward the hoop and tries to kick at it with her foot. It jumps a few inches, and Derek laughs.
Wow, look, a groupie. You could do worse, Ruth Ann says. So how are you doing, Auntie? He asks.
Mom said, she told me that you went to the Indian Health Service. Something shudders across Ruth Ann's face that is gone almost as quickly as I notice it.
Why are we talking about me? Tell me whether I should bet on you winning. I don't even know if I'll place this year, Derek replies. I didn't have a lot of time to practice, what with everything that happened.
Ruth Ann nudges his shoulder and then points to the sky. In an otherwise perfectly clear blue day, a stunted rain cloud hovers.
I think your father's come to make sure you finish well.
Derek looks up at the cloud.
Maybe so.
He bends down to give Sophie a lesson on how to lift up a hoop with one's foot, while Ruth Ann explains that her brother-in-law, Derek's father, was one of the first casualties in the war with Iraq. In keeping with Hopi tradition, his body was to be sent back for burial by the fourth day. But the helicopter carrying his remains was shot down, and so he didn't arrive until 6 days after his death. The family did their best. Yucca soap was used to wash his hair. His mouth was filled with food to keep him satisfied. His possessions were placed in the grave. But it was done 2 days too late, and they worried that he might not make it to his destination.
We spent hours waiting, Ruth Ann tells me. And then, just before it got dark, it rained. Not all over, but on my sister's house and on her fields, and in front of the building where my brother-in-law had gone and enlisted. That's how we knew he'd made it to the next world.
I look up at the cloud she believes is her brother-in-law. What about the ones who don't make it?
They stay lost in this world, Ruth Ann says.
I hold up my palm. I try to convince myself that I feel a drop of rain. Ruth Ann, I ask as we drive back from the herd, how come you live in Mesa?
Because the Phoenician just isn't swanky enough for me.
No, really. I glance in the rearview mirror to make sure Sophie is still sleeping. I didn't realize you had family in the area.
Why does anyone move to a place like where we live?
She asks, shrugging.
Because there's nowhere left to go.
Do you ever go back? Ruth Ann nods.
When I need to remember where I came from or where I'm headed. Maybe I should go, I think.
You haven't asked me why I came to Arizona.
I figured if you wanted to tell me, you would, Ruth Ann says.
I keep my eyes on the highway. My father kidnapped me when I was a baby. He told me my mother had died in a car accident, and he took me from Arizona to New Hampshire. He's in jail now, in Phoenix. I didn't know any of this until a week ago. I didn't know my mother's been alive the whole time. I didn't even know my real name. Ruth Ann looks over her shoulder where Sophie is curled up like a mollusk against Greta's back.
How did you come to call her Sophie?
I guess I just liked it.
On the morning of my daughter's naming, it was up to each of her aunties to suggest a name for her. Her father was Povolnyam, Butterfly Clan, so each of the names had something to do with that. There was Polyquaptiwa, which means butterfly sitting on flower, and Tuahoima, which means butterflies hatching, and Talasvenuma, butterfly carrying pollen on wings. But the one grandmother picked was Kuwan Yauma, butterfly showing beautiful wings. She waited until dawn and then took Kuwan Yauma and introduced her to the spirits for the first time.
You have a daughter? I say, amazed.
She was named for her father's clan, but she belonged to mine, Ruth Ann says. And then she shrugs. When she got initiated, she got a new name. And in school, she was called Luis by the teachers. What I'm saying is that what you're called is hardly ever who you are.
What does your daughter do? I ask. Where does she live?
She's been gone a long time. Luis never figured out that Hopi isn't a word to describe a person, but a destination.
Ruth Ann sighs.
I miss her.
I look through the windshield at the clouds stretched across the horizon. I think about Ruth Ann's brother-in-law, raining on his family's fortune. I'm sorry, I say. I didn't mean to get you upset.
I'm not upset, she answers. If you want to know someone's story, they have to tell it out loud. But every time, the telling is a little bit different. It's new, even to me.
As I listen to Ruth Ann, I start to think that maybe the math is not reciprocal. Maybe depriving a mother of a child is greater than depriving the child of the mother. Maybe knowing where you belong is not equal to knowing who you are.
Have you seen your mother since you've been here? Ruth Ann asks me.
It didn't go so well, I say after a moment.
How come?
I am not ready to tell her about my mother's drinking. She's not what I expected her to be. Ruth Ann turns her head, looks out the window.
No one ever is, she says.
My favorite museum as a child was the New England Aquarium, and my favorite exhibit was the tide pool where you got to play God. There were sea stars which could spit out their own stomachs and grow back limbs that were damaged. There were anemones which might spend all their lives in one place. There were hermit crabs and limpets and algae. There was a red button for me to push, which created a wave in the tank and spun all the sea life like the clothes inside a washing machine before letting them settle again. I loved being the agent of change at the touch of a finger. I'd wait until it seemed the hermit crab had just settled, and then I would push the button again. It was amazing to think of a society where the status quo meant having no status quo at all. There was a second exhibit at the aquarium that I liked, too. A strobe spitting over the flow of an oversized faucet. I knew it was just an optical illusion, but I used to think that in this one corner of the world, water might be able to run backward. Ruth Ann puts me to work, creating her butcher dolls. One day when we are sitting around her kitchen table making divorced Barbie, she comes with Ken's boat, Ken's car, and the deed to Ken's house. She asks, "What did you do in New Hampshire?" I bend closer with the hot glue gun, trying to attach a button. Instead, I wind up affixing Barbie's purse to her forehead. Greta and I found people. Ruth Ann's brows lift.
Like K-9 stuff?
Yeah, except we worked with a whole bunch of police stations.
So why aren't you doing it here?
I look up at her. Because my father is in jail. Because I am embarrassed to have done this for a living without knowing that I was missing. Greta isn't trained for desert work, I say, the first excuse that comes to mind.
So train her.
Ruth Ann, I say, it's just not the right time for us.
You don't get to decide that.
Oh, really? And who does?
The Kuskuska. The ones who are lost.
She bends down over her work again. Is there a little girl somewhere being driven across a border right now? A man with a razor poised over his wrist? A child with one leg over the fence meant to keep him safe from the rest of the world? The desperate usually succeed because they have nothing to lose. But what if that isn't the case? If someone like me had worked in the Phoenix area 28 years ago, would my father have gotten away with it? I suppose I could put out flyers, I tell Ruth Ann. She reaches for the hot glue gun.
Good, she says, because you suck at doll making.
On the way to the desert, Fitz tells me remarkable stories about a heart transplant patient who woke up with a love of the French Riviera, although he'd never left Kansas in his life. Of a teetotaling kidney recipient who, post-surgery, began to drink the same martini her donor favored. By that logic, I argue, then the memory of seeing you for the first time gets stored in my eyeballs. Fitz shrugs.
Maybe it does.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
I'm just telling you what I read.
What about the guy in the 1900s who had a steel pike driven through his brain by accident? I challenge. He woke up speaking Kyrgyzstani.
Well, I highly doubt that, Fitz interrupts, since Kyrgyzstan wasn't a country until 5 years ago.
You're missing the point, I say. What if memories get stored in the brain and they aren't even necessarily ones we've had? What if we're hardwired with a whole iceberg of experiences and our minds use only a tip of them?
That's a pretty cool thought. That you and I would have the same memories just because it's how we're made.
You and I do have the same memories, I point out.
Yeah, but my seeing Eric naked recollection has a whole different causal effect on my system.
Fitz laughs. Maybe I'm not really remembering that stupid lemon tree. Maybe everyone has a lemon stuck in their mind.
Yes, Fitz agrees. Mine, however, is a 78 Pacer.
Very funny.
It wasn't if you were the guy driving it. God, do you remember the time it broke down on the way to the senior prom?
I remember the oil on your date's dress. What was her name? Carly?
Casey Bosworth. And she wasn't my date by the time we got there.
I pull off the road into a vista of pebbles and red earth, and then hand Fitz a bottle of water and a roll of toilet paper. You remember the drill, right? He will lay a trail for Greta and me to follow, just like he's done for years in New Hampshire. But because this terrain is unfamiliar to me, Fitz will leave bits of toilet paper on trees and cacti as he goes, to let me know that Greta is on the right trail. He gets out of the car and leans down into the window. I don't think we covered coyote protection in the training manual. I wouldn't worry about the coyotes, I say sweetly. I'd be far more panicked about the snakes. Funny, Fitz replies, and he starts walking, a massive redhead who was going to be a hectic shade of sunburned pink in no time at all. If Greta screws up, drive south. I'll be hanging out with the Border Patrol drinking tequila. Greta won't screw up. Hey, Fitz, I call out and wait until he turns, shading his eyes. I actually wasn't kidding about the snakes. As I drive off, I watch Fitz in the rearview mirror, staring down nervously at his feet. It makes me laugh out loud. Memories aren't stored in the heart or the head or even the soul, if you ask me, but in the spaces between any given two people. According to the Hopi, sometimes we no longer fit the world we've been given. In the beginning, there was only darkness and Tiowa, the sun spirit. He created the first world and filled it with creatures that lived in a cave deep in the earth. But they fought among themselves, so he sent Spider Grandmother down to prepare them for a change. As Spider Grandmother led the creatures into the second world, Tiowa changed them. They were no longer insects, but animals with fur and webbed fingers and tails. They were happy to have the space to roam free, but they didn't understand life any better than before. Tiowa sent Spider Grandmother back to lead the way into the third world. By now, the animals had transformed into people. They made villages and planted corn. But it was cold in the third world and mostly dark. Spider Grandmother taught them to weave blankets to keep warm. She told the women to make clay pots to store water and food. But in the cold, the pots couldn't be baked. The corn wouldn't grow. One day, a hummingbird came to the people in the fields. He had been sent by Masawu, ruler of the upper world and caretaker of the place of the dead. He brought with him fire, and he taught the people its secret. With this new discovery, the people could harden their pots and warm their fields and cook their food. For a while, they lived in peace. But sorcerers emerged with medicine to hurt those they didn't like. Men gambled instead of farming. Women grew wild, forgetting their babies so that the fathers had to care for the children. People began to brag that there was no God, that they had created themselves. Spider Grandmother returned. She told the people that those of good heart would leave this place and the evil ones behind. They did not know where to go, but they had heard footsteps overhead in the sky. So the chiefs and the medicine men took clay and shaped a swallow out of it, wrapped it in a bride's robe, and sang it to life. The swallow flew toward the opening in the sky, but he was not strong enough to make it through. The medicine men decided to make a stronger bird, and they sang forth a dove. It flew through the opening and returned, saying, "On the other side there is a land that spreads in all directions, but there is nothing alive up there." Still, the chiefs and the medicine men had heard footsteps. They fashioned a catbird this time and asked him to ask the one who made the footsteps for permission to enter his land. The catbird flew past the point where all the other birds had gone. He found sand and mesas. He found ripe squash and blue corn and splitting melons. He found a single stone house and its master, Masawu. When he returned, he told the chiefs and the medicine men that Misawu would allow them to come. They looked up, wondering how they would ever reach the hole in the sky. They went off to find Chipmunk, the planter. Chipmunk planted a sunflower seed in the ground, and by the power of singing, the people made it grow. But it bent over with its own weight and could not reach the hole. Chipmunk planted a spruce and then a pine, but neither grew tall enough. Finally, he planted a bamboo, and the people began to sing. Every time they stopped to catch their breath, the bamboo stopped growing and a notch formed. Finally, the bamboo passed through the hole in the sky. Only the pure people were allowed into this fourth world. Spider Grandmother went up the bamboo first with her two warrior grandsons. As the people emerged, a mockingbird sorted them into Hopi and Navajo, Zuni and Pima, Ute and Supai, Sioux and Comanche, and Whites. The warrior grandsons took their buckskin ball and played their way across the earth, creating mountains and mesas. Spider Grandmother made a sun and a moon. Coyote tossed the leftover materials into the sky to make the stars. The Hopi will tell you that evil managed to sneak in up the bamboo anyway. That the time of this fourth world is almost done. Any day now, they say, we might find ourselves in a new one. Tracking with a bloodhound takes away from the romance of scent. The smell that makes you want to bury your face in the neck of your lover. The trace of perfume that turns men's heads when a beautiful woman walks by. These are merely skin cells decomposing. For Greta and me, scent is a matter of serious business. After buckling on her leash, I walk Greta over to the baseball cap Fitz has left behind. Lifting it up, I watch her breathe in so deeply the fabric sucks into her nostrils. "Find him," I instruct, and Greta leaps over the bent fence and heads off, nose to the ground. This is a world populated by birds with unlikely names. The common flicker, the Harris hawk, the Mexican jay. We see agave plants and chain fruit cholla, rose mallow, paintbrush, tack stem. We walk by flora that I have only seen in books. Brittlebush and cheeseweed, fillery, jojoba. We pass cacti that are mutations, their arms growing inward instead of out, their heads twisted like the folds of a human brain. Greta moves across the flat of the land slowly. I keep my eyes on the plump arms of the saguaros and the Modigliani necks of the ocotillo, where every now and then Fitz has left me a piece of toilet paper to let me know that Greta's heading in the right direction. She stops at the dried-out husk of a saguaro and sits down. Suddenly, she plants all 4 feet firmly on the ground and bares her teeth. The hair on the line of her spine stands on end. She growls. The javelina is about 4 feet long with a bristled gray hide. Its yellowed tusks turn down at the ends. It has a mane that runs the length of its back. It looks up from its meal of prickly pear and grunts. I can never remember if you are supposed to run from a bear or stay perfectly still. I have absolutely no clue if there is safety etiquette for a javelina. The pig takes a cocky step toward Greta, who skitters sideways. I pull on her leash just in time to keep her from crashing into a stubby medusa of a cactus. Suddenly, Greta yelps and falls to the ground, clawing at her nose. The cactus she didn't brush into has somehow managed to hook itself into her snout. Spines cover her muzzle. A few have worked their way into the gummy black gasket of her lips. Greta's mournful howl sends a flock of cactus wrens to the skies. The javelina, startled, thunders off. Without a second thought, I kneel down and haul Greta over my shoulders in a fireman's carry. I don't feel her 75 pounds as I start running. Fitz! I yell as loud as I can, and I try to find him with the clues he's left us. We are bent over Greta in the back of the Explorer. I'm lying over her to keep her from moving and stroking her head and her ears. Fitz leans close to her snout, pulling the spines free with a pair of needle-nose pliers I carry in my emergency kit.
"I think they call it teddy bear choya," he says. "Nasty stuff. It jumps at you."
When he opens Greta's mouth gently, she snaps at him.
"Almost finished, sweetheart,"
Fitz soothes, and he pulls the last spines out of her gums. Then he leans forward to make sure he hasn't missed any.
"That's it. You may want to double-check my veterinary skills with a professional, but I think she's going to be okay."
I take one look at Greta, and then at Fitz, and burst into tears. "I hate it here," I say. "I hate how hot it is, and that there are snakes, and that nothing's green. I hate the smell of that stupid jail. I want to go home."